Chodesh Tov.
Hi.
Oh, yeah, ask him to put it on silent.
Don't forget to put it on silent.
Yehuda, can you put it on silent? Okay.
Okay, with that.
Oops, sorry. So, Rosa, we're here on Chaf Hei Amid Beis. Yes, Chaf Hei Amid Beis? So the Gemara says, Avodah Zorah, Hodi Amorah. So the law that Yehorg Val Yavra, they have to give up your life rather than worship an idol, that we derived from V'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha, B'chol Nafshecha. Afilu hu notel es Nafshecha. Ki Arayus Ushvichas Domim. How do we know that in these two cases, the Avera is so severe that you cannot override it even for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh, and we suspend the principle of Achai Bohem? And the answer is, we derive this, Rebbe derives this in a brisa from a Hekesh. The Torah itself compares Ritzicha to Gili Arayis, and it says in Parshas, Ki Teitze Ki Kasha Yokum Ish Al Re'eu Ritzachon Nefesh Kein HaDover HaZeh. In the parish of Nara Murasa, and this woman is a married woman, after Erusin she's considered Eishes Ish, and therefore anyone other than her Orus who would have a relationship with her would be in violation of Gili Arayis. She too, if she would willingly submit to such an action, would be in violation of Gili Arayis. And the Torah says that her situation, if she was out there in the wilderness, and even if she screamed, there was no one there to hear her, she is a victim of a rape situation, and therefore her situation, says the Torah, is equal to that of a person who's murdered. Ki kasher yokum ish ha-re'eu ritzachon nefesh kein hadover hazeh. Just like in the case of a person, if Reuven kills Shimon is a victim and he died, and he's not responsible. So too, in a case of a woman who was raped, and the Gili Arayis was forced upon her, she is not held guilty at all. And here we have a very interesting chiddush. There's actually a big debate about this between Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who lived about 200 years ago, and Rabbi Chaim Brisker, who lived about 100 years ago. What does the Torah mean when the Torah compares her situation in a rape to the victim of murder? Rabbi Kivega said that what the Torah is trying to convey is that her situation is that she's completely relieved of any sort of liability, of any sort of punishment, and it's what's called a ptur onshin. Rabbi Chaim said no. Rabbi Chaim says it's much more fundamental and far-reaching. It means that she's not considered to be part of a ma'isa aver at all. And she's just an object, so to speak. She's not in any way guilty of some sort of a maisa. And that's how Reb Chaim understood it. Now, the Bryce of Rebbe asks the following naive question. It says, V'chima in yerotzech etzel nara mura. So why would the Torah bring in one pasuk two different issues that seem so fundamentally far removed one from the other? The Torah wants to tell you that the anusa here, that she was raped, she's ptura from the onesh skila, she doesn't get the normal punishment of skila. I know this already. The Torah says, in that same context, in a different pasuk, it says, v'lanara lo tasa dover, that there's no punishment that's meted out to this woman. So why did the Torah have to go ahead and compare her to the case of a victim of a murder crime? And Rebbe says the following. We apply one of the midos shatorah nidreshes b'hem, one of the rules by which we interpret the Torah, and that's called a hekesh. And that rule says that ain't hekesh l'mechtu, which means that a hekesh always tells me that you compare A to B and B to A, and it goes in a two-way street. Harezeh bo l'lamed v'nimtza lamed. In other words, each one here is coming to teach something and shed a light on the other one, and also vice versa, there's a light being shed on it. Makish rotseach lenara murasa. So let's go in one direction. And here, the Torah is comparing rotseach to nara murasa to tell you something about rotseach. Ma nara murasa nitan latsila benafsho. Af rotseach nitan latsila benafsho. So Rashi explains that in the case of nara murasa, in the case of gilui arayos, the Torah has taught us that you can kill the potential rapist in order to save her if need be. And Rashi tells you that this is derived in the Gemara in Sanhedrin from a pasuk, V'ein Moshiela. So I want you to see this inside, and you're counting down from the top of the page in Rashi approximately 10 lines. The Rashi says, Nitan Latsila, Nitan Rishus L'Roash U'Rodef Achrea, if you're a spectator and you see that somebody is running after her, is the Torah gives you Rishus, gives you the green light, Shiatzilena, to save her, Mimenu, from this rapist, Benafsho Shel Rodef, even if it means taking the life of the Rodef. It's an unbelievable halacha. I don't think any, to my knowledge, there's any other legal system that has such a thing, Lahavdil. How do we derive this halach that you can kill the rode for the case of gilui arayos if need be? The pasuk says again in Parashas Ki Teitse, "V'ein Moshiah la." No one was there to save her, and therefore lanara lo sasa dover. We don't punish her in any way. Ha. Huh? What do we derive from this? Yesh Moshiah, if there is someone who could save her, Tzarech Lahoshia, he has to go ahead and do whatever he needs to do to save her. B'chol Asher Yochel, whatever means at his disposal. Afilu Barigoso, even in the worst case scenario, he has nothing to do but to kill him. V'im Eino Yochel Hatzel Biachem Meivorav Yargenu, if he can't shoot for the leg, so to speak, then you kill him. And now the same thing applies in the case of Rotzeach. You saw Reuven running after Shimon. Reuven is about to kill Shimon. You can kill Reuven if need be in order to save Shimon. And that's where Rotzeach is derived from. Gilui arayos from Nara Murasa. Nara Murasa becomes the Melamed, and Rotzeach becomes the Nilmad, or the Lamed, if you want to use that word. Now we want to go the other direction. Because as we said before, Ein Hekish Lemechza. So now, Nara Murasa is going to be derived from Rotzeach, meaning Rotzeach now is going to teach me something about Nara Murasa. And what is that? So Rebbe says the following. Nara Murasa Rotzeach, Ma Rotzeach, Yehorg Val Yavar. So if somebody forces you to kill someone else, then rather than kill him, you have to submit yourself to die. That's called Yehorg. The Al Yavar is Af Nara Murasa. So too, and she has two choices. Either she can submit herself for this action of Gilui arayos, or she can die. Is Tehareg Val Tavar. She has to be willing to give up her life. And again, we pointed out yesterday that Tosfos changes the girsa here. If you take a look on the top line in Tosfos, the Divrei Maskil, his girsa is Yehareg Val Yavar. If a man is forced to have a relationship with an Eishes Ish at the pain of death, he has to be willing to give up his life, Yehorg Val Yavar, so he shouldn't be Ba'al Ha'erva, so he shouldn't have a Maisa of Gilui arayos. However, in the case of a woman, here Tosfos applies a principle, which we spoke about yesterday at great length. Anybody remember that principle? Karka Olam? You gotta memorize it. I can't, there are no shortcuts here.
Completely passive.
Correct. Correct. But sometimes, Gershon, it's important to know the language, you know, because I'll tell you why, because the language appears here, there, and elsewhere, and you have to know how to make comparisons and so forth. So, you know, we live in a generation where, and I'm guilty of this too, we translate everything into English, so we lose the terminology. We have to remember the terminology, Karka Olam. And Tosfos claims, based on a Gemara in Ksubis, and also a Gemara in Sanhedrin, that we have a mitigating factor with regard to a woman in Gilui arayos, that she is karkola, meaning she is passive. And therefore she didn't do a maisa, an active maisa of Gilui arayos. Now it doesn't mean, again as I emphasized yesterday, I want to reemphasize, it doesn't mean that in a case where she agreed to have this relationship on her own, that she's less guilty and less liable than he is. They're both going to be killed if there was Edom HaAsra and so forth and so on. But in the case of Yehoi Val Yavar, here's where she plays a different role than he. She can submit herself if she's passive, and that's called Karka Olam. And therefore, tehor, and therefore tavor v'al tehor. Therefore, she will be in a sense participating, but again, passively in the skilia rice in order to save her life. And Tosa says, why is karkolim such a meaningful mitigating circumstance to change the halacha from tehor v'al tavor to tavor v'al tehor? Tosa says because of this equation to rotzeah. That even in the case of Rotzeach, there's a concept called Karka Olam. There's such a thing as killing someone passively. If the Anos says to you, I'm going to give you two choices. Either allow yourself to be thrown, I'll throw you on the baby, and the baby will die. Or if you refuse, I will kill you. In such a case, you're allowed to be thrown on the baby, even though the baby will die. Why? Because you're not making any decision that your blood is redder than his. And that's what the Gemara is going to say now. Ushvichas domim gufe minolon. We're saying that the din of Yehoi Val Yavar in Gilui Arayis is derived from Ritzicha based on this Hekesh. Well, how do we know that in Rotzeach Gufa that the Torah says Yehoi Val Yavar? And the Gemara answers Svarahu that Eino Chinami, there is no source in the Torah for the fact that I'm not allowed to kill someone to save my life. That law is derived logically from Svara. Now again, when I say logically, I don't want anyone to get the misimpression. Svara is not logic. Svara is a rational analysis that's based on the Torah law. So you can't come up with your own Svara. You know, I can't say, well, you know, I'm gonna eat chaza because I'm not gonna get trigonosis. You know, I'm gonna come up with a new svara, you know, to allow me to do this. No, svara also works within a halachic framework. And here, what we say is the following: my chazis the domach didach sumach tve. So the Gemara says ki Yahudi osel kamei the rav. The Gemara, remember this? We finished yesterday. Do you remember this from yesterday, those who were here yesterday? I mean, other people were maybe in far-flung places on the earth, but those who were here in good old Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh yesterday, here in this classroom, may remember the story of someone who apparently they gave him one day to kill somebody. They said, if you don't kill him within the next 24 hours, we're going to kill you, and we know how to find you. And he came during that 24-hour period that he had to stay until he had to decide what to do. He came in front of Rava. He tells Rava the whole story. Omale Mare Durai. He's the governor of the city. Omale, he told me the following. This was his choice that he gave me. Zil Katle Laplani, go kill so-and-so. V'ilo, if you don't kill him, Katlina Loch, I'll kill you. And he tells Rava that if I don't use this very short period of time to kill so-and-so, then the Moshe La'ir is going to get a hold of me and he's going to kill me. Am I allowed to kill that person to save myself? After all, the Torah says, Lo Tirtzach, but the Torah also says, V'chaimahem. So we have now a head-on collision between the Avera of Ritzicha and the Halach of Pikuach Nefesh. So Rava says, Liktaluch, you have to allow him to kill you, V'lo Tiktalo, and you're not allowed to kill him. And the way Tosus learns it, it means you're not allowed to actively kill him. And we'll see exactly why there's a mitigating factor called Karkolam here, and that's going to impact on her situation in Gilui Arayis. And what's the logic here that compels us to the conclusion that you're not allowed to kill him? Why can't I kill him for the sake of saving my life? And the Gemara says, my chaz is the domach didach sumach tve. Who says your blood is redder than his? Dilma perhaps, domach tahu gava sumach tve. Maybe his blood is redder than yours. So what we want to do today, which we did not get a chance to do yesterday, and this is where we start our new learning for today, is this long Rashi, Dibra Maskel Mai Chazis. Rashi says the following. It's about, shall we say, 15 lines down from the top of the page. I don't know if that makes it helpful for anybody?
Yeah?
Klomar, Rashi says. Klum Basa Lishol Alkach. What was the logical underlying reason for your question, the reasoning of your question, Elamit Neshata Yodea, because you're aware of the halach of Achaibahem, She'ein mitzvah omedes b'fnei pikuach nefesh. The Torah says, live by the law, but don't die by the law. And that's called pikuach nefesh. V'savur ato, you think, sha'af zu, and even this avera of lo tirtzach, tidochem et nei pikuach nafshecha. We should have pikuach nefesh, the power of a chaybem, to override lo tirtzach. So I'm not allowed to kill him because the Torah says don't kill him. But the Torah says that whatever avera I'm giving you, I'm telling you not to do, you can do it. You can override that avera if need be, for the sake of pikuach nefesh. So you want to be able to kill him and violate lo tirtzach for the greater good of pikuach nefesh, in this case to save yourself. Savur, you think. Yeah, it's very interesting because Rashi's telling us how Rav is analyzing the thought process of the Makshan. I don't know if you're familiar with tshuva literature. Always, when you see a tshuva response, you'll always see how he goes through the logic of the shoel, the one who asked the question. Sovarata, you think, shafdu, even this aver of lo tirtzach, like all the other averes in the Torah, with one exception, that's avodah zarah, is tidache, could be overridden by mipnei pikuach nafshecha, for the sake of pikuach nefesh. Wait a minute. Is there only one nefesh at stake here on the line? There's only pikuach nafshecha? This case is not similar to violating and overriding any other avera. Why? Because in this case, what are you going to apply? Pikuach nafshecha. I have a secret for you. Become a koyesh kani ibud nefesh. No matter which way you turn, we're going to lose a nefesh. Why? Because if you refuse to kill him, you'll be killed. If you agree and kill him, he'll be killed. So whose pikuach nefesh is more significant? HaTorah lo itiro litchos ha-mitzvah v'nechivas nafshu shel Yisrael. When the Torah says v'chai bohem, the ultimate goal or end of saving a nefesh of Yisrael is going to allow you to override a mitzvah of the Torah. But Khan, here in this particular case, havera nases, even after you do the havera, again, the whole logic of pikuach nefesh doche, is that the aver is going to be implemented, but you're going to save a nefesh, and for the sake of saving a nefesh, we're going to allow you to violate the aver. But Khan, in this case, havera nases v'nefesh avuda. Even after you do the avera, you still end up with a loss of life. Now again, if you could make a decision on a scale and do what we call today triage, and then decide that your life is more significant than his, so then maybe we could say, you know what, for the sake of saving your life, we're going to be matir lo tirtzach, the violation of ritzicha. But we can't make that decision. Mi yemar, who's going to tell us? Nobody could tell us. That your nefesh is more important than his. Dilma, perhaps, let's play the devil's advocate here. Shel zeh, the nefesh of the other one, the guy who's going to be killed, chaviva tfei olav, maybe it's more cherished in the eyes of God. So therefore, what are we going to be left with? We, as far as weighing this on the scale, two nefashos, Rashi says, they're shkulos, they're equal. You know, you can't decide which nefesh is more significant than the other. Is nimtza, if you kill him, that we're going to lose a nefesh. We've already violated the principle of achai bohem of pikuach nefesh. The avera nases, and yet the avera will be done. So what you have here is the following. In Hilchas Pikuach Nefesh, we're left with a stalemate. We don't know whether to save this nefesh or that nefesh, which nefesh is more chaviva olav. And therefore we have a total stalemate. Everything freezes. So now what, if v'chai bohem and pikuach nefesh freezes, then what's going to allow you to violate lo sirtzach? What remains constant here and untouched is the lav and the aver of lo tirtzach. So again, if you were to ask me, well, pikuach nefesh versus lo tirtzach, then maybe I would be able to say that for the sake of pikuach nefesh, we're going to violate lo tirtzach. But that's only hypothetical. That only exists in the conceptual world. Because by definition, when you violate lo tirtzach, somebody else is going to die. And if somebody else is going to die, we have now pikuach nefesh on both sides. Do you hear the logic over here? Rashi's telling you that in theory, Rav is willing to grant, he's willing to admit that the theoretical premise or principle that's embodied in the question of the Shoel is correct. You're right. The Torah says v'chai bohem. You can violate any aver in the Torah for the sake of v'chai bohem. And therefore, you can violate lo tirtzach for the sake of v'chai bohem. But there's only one problem. I can't apply v'chai b'hem here. Because v'chai b'hem means that when you violate the avera, somebody's life is spared. But in the case where somebody's going to die anyway, and we can't determine which life is more significant than the other, then v'chai b'hem is totally inoperative here. Because v'chai b'hem is meant to tell me that by violating the avera, it's a means to an end of saving a life. But if even after the avera is still going to take human life, then how can we make this decision? We're going to have to take v'chayvim and put it on the back burners. V'chayvim is not going to operate at all. Why? Because we have one v'chayvim against the other v'chayvim, and it's an actual stalemate. And then what we're left with is lo tirtzach, because if we have no v'chayvim, there's nothing to be matir, to be docha lo tirtzach. And therefore, you're not allowed to kill this man.
The person who will be killed in this case has to rise above his natural inclination for self-preservation. He has to take a more objective view,
right,
from Hashem's point of view, that there's two souls in question.
Right. That's what we said yesterday. Gershon was pointing out the Rambam's writings to those communities that did not give up their life on Kiddush Hashem, or those individuals, that we still have to keep them within the fold. Because, again, this demand of Yehori Vel Yavor is on a very high level. You know, not to take the law into your hands in order to save your own life, you know, when you're in that situation. This is, I don't know if you've ever heard of the famous story. This took place on Rosh Hashanah, the year 1941. On Rosh Hashanah, you know, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, loved to round up the Jews for death on Jewish holidays. This is a known fact. And Rosh Hashanah was one of the worst. So in that case, I don't remember the name of the camp right now, but the one who writes this whole story up is Rav Oshri. He was like the posek. I think it was in Auschwitz, if I'm not mistaken. Where was it?
I don't remember. I remember the name.
So they had a list of 1,400 children to be taken out to be killed on that Rosh Hashanah. And one of the fathers of one of those children who was taken in on the list of 1,400 came over to Rav Oshri, and he said, "I smuggled out on my way out to the cattle cars, I smuggled out something of value. And I think I could bribe the capo, and I could save my son." So Rav Oshri asked him, "So what's the shaila?" "Of course, do whatever you can to save your son." But he said he knows that because the capo has to fill this quota of 1,400, another child who is not included in the 1,400 would be taken in. And when Rav Oshri realized what's going on over here, the nature of this question to save your life, in this case your son's life, at the expense of someone else's life, so Rav Oshri kept pushing him off. You know, he avoided the question. You know, how could I answer? You know, he looked, you can imagine what he looked like there. Nobody looked like a rough over there, you know. And then finally, at the end, the father said to Rav Oshri, "So what should I do?" So Rav Oshri said, "You're asking me to paskin on something that would require a Sanhedrin of 71 elders, and I don't have a sefer in my hand than anything." And from the back and forth, the father understood that Rav Oshri was really hinting at him that there's no clear-cut permission in this case to save yourself at the expense of someone else. Anyway, the end of the story is that the father got up on Rosh Hashanah and he said to the Ribbono Shalom, apparently they overheard him, that my trial was even greater than that of Avraham Avinu. Because at the end of the day, Avraham Avinu did not sacrifice his son, and I sacrificed my son. And not only that, Avraham Avinu had a clear-cut mandate. I didn't have a clear-cut mandate. Yeah, that's one of the famous stories. So like you say, you know, self-preservation, you know, I how could a person overcome his desire to save himself, and in this case his son, which maybe is even greater. And the Torah is saying, Yehori Val Yavar, I mean, that's really... Now let's get back to Karka Olam. So Tosa says that if they're going to force you to be thrown on the Tinoch, there you're not actively deciding whose blood is redder than the other. So there's no active involvement in Ritzich. And therefore you're allowed to be totally passive. And Tosfos says that by virtue of this equation between Rotseach and Nara Murasa, teaching you mean that even in the case of Gilat Rais, we're not going to allow a violation of Gilat Rais, even for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh, meaning just like we suspended the principle of Achaibem and Pikuach Nefesh in the case of Ritzicha, so too by virtue of this equation of this Hekish, we're going to suspend Pikuach Nefesh in the case of Gilat Rais. It's almost as if to say that we don't have the power, the ability to decide between Gili Arayas and Pikuach Nefesh. So we're left in a stalemate, just like in the case of you kill him or I'll kill you, we're left with a stalemate. Here too, in the case of Gili Arayas, we're left with a stalemate. So what you have to do is, you have to avoid Gili Arayas. But if, let's say, you're totally passive, and that's going to be the situation of a woman who's Karka Olam, then it's like the case of the Tinok, where I'm not doing anything actively to kill the baby, I'm just being used as a human cannonball, as we said yesterday. That's not my decision, that's not my action, and therefore the halacha would be Yavar V'Alyei Horeik. So that was what we did yesterday. So I'm just going to read to you an overview here. He has a summary here in Masifta of this Tosfos that we did yesterday, and he writes the following. He says that Isha eina mechuyeves limsar nafsha mishum shehi karka olam klomar she'eina osa shum maise kemevur b'Sanhedrin. And he's referring here to the sugya of Esther. Today's Rosh Chodesh Adar Beis, so we can talk about Esther. That Esther was allowed to be married to Achashverosh because in the Gili Arayis with Achashverosh, assuming she was a married woman, she was totally passive, and that's called karka olam. Varei makar din yehorik v'yav, the source of yehorik v'yav v'arayis is miritzicha. V'gam miritzicha lo nemar din zeh el k'sha'omrim lo im lo taro gesploni. If you don't kill so-and-so, and as actively kill him, nahargucha will kill you. Aval im omar lo hanach lonu lizrok oscha al atinok ulo hargo v'im lo nargecha she'eno osa shum maise bariga zu eno mechuyiv limsar es nafsho kedei lahatzil satinok. Shekein kol din yehorik v'alyav ritzichu mishum svaras maichazis v'yein lesa mishum kachel ahariga b'yodayim av k'she'eno osa maisa yeshlomo lehepach maichazis edomach techavri sumach tfei. Why do I have to have myself killed? Is my blood any less red than his blood? Madua olai li horeg. Do I have to be killed in order to save someone else? That I don't have to do. So as long as there's no active ritzicha where I'm saying that my life is more important than his, then the din would be Yavar V'al Yehori. And now, Rabosai, we start a new sugya. It's not exactly a new sugya, because, bless you, you may recall that we had a principle that whenever you derive the Isra Hanah from the Isra Achila, and we gave a few examples, the Shor Niskal, where the Torah says you're not allowed to eat the Shor, is Arlo, where the Torah says you're not allowed to eat the fruits for the first 3 years, and we had Basa B'Cholov, which is derived from a Kal V'Chomer from Arlo, we had Klaya Kerem, we had many cases of Isra Hanah. If the Isra Hanah is derived from Achila, then the halacha is you have to do it kedarko, the derech haregila, the way people do it. So the Gemara is now swinging back to that sugya. And we're talking about Orla again. Orla, as we said, is Isuri Hanah. Marbar of Ashi, Ashkeche l'Ravina. So Marbar of Ashi found Ravina. What was he doing, Ravina? Deshoyefle lebrate biguakre di Orla. Now the word guarakai or guaraki is an Aramaic word for bosar. Now we don't understand the Hebrew any better than the Aramaic, so by translating into Hebrew I don't think we gain much. But what is bosar? Now bosar is a word that appears all over Seder Zeroyim. You know, the Torah Shebaal Peh is divided into six wings or six branches, one of which is called Zeroyim, the laws of agriculture. And in the laws of agriculture, especially with regard to olives, you know, olives, Zeisim, they appear almost in every single section of Orla, of Zeroyim, and certainly in Orla. So we have a concept of Bosar. Bosar is a very early stage of development. Correct? Which means that from the point that the olives reach the state of Bosar, at that point the olives become Osir Be'orla. And now we find that Ravina took the oil that was extracted from Zese Bosar, the small Zesim of Orla. And what did he do with this oil that he extracted from Orla? He used it for refuah. He used it for medicinal purposes to anoint his daughter, who was apparently ill, for medicinal purposes. Abalei, so Mar Ravashi, when he saw this happening, Amor, he says, how can you do such a thing? Amor di Omar Rabbanon Bishas HaSakana. When did the Rabbanon say that you're allowed to violate Isur HaNoah for the sake of health? That's only if it's in a life-threatening situation. And that's called Pikuach Nefesh. In other words, it was clear, it was understood by Ravina, I'm sorry, by Mar Ravashi, excuse me, that with this, the status, the situation of the daughter of Ravina was not a life-threatening situation. And therefore, Shalom B'Shas HaSakana Mi Omer, did the Rabbanon allow you to violate an Isur HaNoah, which is Doraisa, for the sake of someone who's not in a Shas HaSakana? Again, you know, he has issues, and maybe she had skin problems. I don't know what the issue was, but nevertheless, she was not in the state of Sakana. So what were you thinking? What was the permission granted to you to violate the Isra Ana from Zeisei Orla? Orla is also Bana. Amalei, so Ravina told Ravashi, my Ravashi, that he was unaware of one of the facts of the case. Ha ishata smirta, which means that the ash, which means the fever, was smirta, was very high. She was suffering from a very high fever, and it was absolutely critical to lower her fever. And in modern Hebrew, that's called kadachas or kadachat. Kuf dalid chet. Tough when you have an uncontrollable fever, let's say 105 in Fahrenheit, right? So it's very, very high. Nami kishasa sakona damya. And high fever is also considered life-threatening. And therefore the halacha pikuach nefesh kicks in, and although you're right that I was violating the Isra Ano from Orla, from Shemin Shel Orla, but nevertheless, I was allowed to do so for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh, because that was the way I could lower her fever. That's the first answer of the Gemara. So I just, you know, since the Gemara is telling a story, I like to tell a story too. And my father told me this story, and he said he heard it twice from his Rebbe, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And every time Rav Moshe picked up his leg and banged it down at the same point in the story. So Rav Moshe tells the following story. And you see the honesty of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, that he, even though the story is a little bit embarrassing for himself, it indicates that he slipped, but nevertheless he was willing to tell the story because it had a halachic implication. So it turns out like this. Rav Moshe was the father at this point of one child. He had one little boy, and this little baby's name was Yosef Dov, Yosef Ber, as they called him. And Reb Chaim, meaning Reb Moshe's father, was visiting at that point Reb Moshe. I think the name of the city, if I remember correctly, was Rasayin. I don't remember the name of the city. But anyway, Reb Chaim was there, and it was Shabbos. And little Yosha Ber took sick, and he had a very, very high fever. Now, in those days, they didn't have lights like we do. they had those kerosene, what do they call them? Lanterns?
Lamps.
So when the physician came to see the baby on that Friday night, and there were three people in the room other than the physician. There was the father, there was the grandfather, and there was the little baby. So the physician turns to the father and he says, lower the light, because the light is bothering the baby's eyes and he has a very high fever, which is extremely dangerous. Now, to lower the light on Shabbos is a question of Meleches Kibud. It's one of the 39 Melechas. So at that point, when the father of Moshe got the instruction for the physician to lower the lamp, he started shaking, Reb Moshe. So Reb Chaim picked up his foot, and this is how Reb Moshe imitated his father, slammed it down and called him an Amoretz. You're an ignoramus. That's what he called his own son. This is Pikuach Nefesh, and why are you hesitating? And Reb Moshe told the story, I think my father said he heard it twice from Reb Moshe over the 5 years that he learned by Reb Moshe. And both times, exactly at that point in the story, Reb Moshe picked up his foot and slammed it down. And Reb Chaim slammed down his foot. Because in the brisk, you have to tell the story exactly as it happened. You know, it's part of the Mesoris HaTorah. But anyway, why do I mention this story? Because just like the daughter of Ravina was suffering from a high fever, and here it wasn't even a matter of Shabbos. You know, Shabbos, to violate the Shabbos is because, you know, that's already a chiyuv skila. It's a capital crime. Here it was a violation of an Isra Hanah. We vacillated back and forth, if you recall, whether you get Malkus for violating an Isra Hanah. And we had a whole bunch of Shitos. Again, the Gemara seems to say the opposite, but many Rishonim and Achronim say that you don't get Malkus for an Isra Hanah. And yet, the Gemara says, and that's what Mar Bar Vashi was up in arms, how could Ravina do such a thing and violate an Isra Hanah from Zeisei Arla? And the answer is because of a high fever. So this has tremendous repercussions, halacha lemaisa, in terms of pikuach nefesh in the case of kadachas, which means a high fever. And again, the physicians will have to determine at what point is a high fever very dangerous. You know, today they have things like they put you in a cold bath. You know, there are many different methods of trying to lower fever. They give you suppositories, they give you intravenous sometimes. It's really critical to lower fever. But Ika de Gyamri, now the Gemara, has a different version of exactly what Ravina responded to Mar Bar Avashi. Not that he responded, well, this is Pikuach Nefesh, and that's why I'm allowed to use this oil of Arla to smear it on my daughter's body, but rather, Midi Derech Hanaka Vidna. You may recall that in the case of Arla, we said that the Shemen of Arla is used primarily for Meshichas Oros, right, to use it in the tanning process. But to use it as a refuah, that's an unusual way of doing such a thing. And therefore, this is not a violation of the Isra Hanah from Arla. Now here we have two versions of exactly what Ravina said to Mar Rav Ashi. And they really hinge on the following question. Is there such a thing as a ptur, as a mitigating circumstance, which is called lo kederech hanah with regard to Isra Hanah? The second lashon, the Ikad Amri, assumes that if you use it shelo kederech hanah asam, that's not a violation of the Isra Hanah. Well, that's a big chiddush. And if you recall, we said there were two versions back in Rabbi Yochanan regarding this question. And according to one version, the halach of shelo kederech applies to achila, but it doesn't apply to hanah. Any hanah, any benefit that you get from it, is a violation of hanah. So the first lishnah has to justify Ravina's actions, not based on shelo kederecha, and it's not derech hanah, it's unusual, but rather under a different halacha of pikuach nefesh, because the high fever generates a sakana. And the second lashon says, no, the same requirement that we derive from achila, that you have to have an achila kedarka, so too, to violate the Isra Hanah, which is derived from achila, it has to be kedarka. And this Meshicha, when he used the oil of the Zeisei Arla as an ointment, that is considered shalo kedarka. Now here we have a Rashi, Dira Maskel Derech. And Rashi adds another element into the equation. I told you, and this is I think the simple pshat before Rashi, that the reason why this is Shaloki Darko is because what do you do with oil? What is it designated for? And the answer is it's singled out for Meshichas Oros. But Rashi introduced another variable into the equation. And Rashi says, Derech HaNa'oso, I don't know if you can find this Rashi. And he said, yeah, what is it?
Right in the middle,
okay, if that helps anybody. So he says, finally, Acharshi is Bashlu. Does anybody know what the word Yisbashlu means?
Okay.
Well, yeah, no, that's...
Boiled?
Say it again?
Boiled?
No. I mean, it does, all that you say is correct, but not in this context. The word Yisbashlu has a different meaning. It's one of those words in Lashon Kodesh that have multiple meanings. Yisbashlu means to ripen, R-I-P-E-N. And basically what Rashi is learning is that we don't take the Zasim, Don, you'll be interested in this because of, you know, all the archaeology and so forth. You know, if you go to Kiryat Gat and all these places, how do you say Gat in English?
Press.
You know, a press, excellent, an oil press, right? Today, you know, it's in many different places in Israel because the archaeological digs, you can see oil presses that date back, you know, millennia. And in the oil presses, they would not take the zeisim, the olives, to the oil press to squeeze to extract the oil until it reached a certain stage when the zeisim were mature on the tree. Then, but when they're very small in a state of bosar, they've been getting state, and it's not nisbashel, it didn't ripen on the tree yet. It was unusual to take the oil, extract the oil from these small zeisim. It was just a waste of good money, because if you waited a couple of months, then the zeisim, the olives, will ripen on the tree and get a lot more, you know, a lot more for your buck. You know, you get a lot more oil for your buck. And therefore, that's considered shalo kederech hana'osam. That's not the normal way of hana'os. So it's not because he used it for a fool that shalo kederech hana'osam, but rather because he used it prematurely when the zeisim were only in the state of bosar. The Rambam, on the other hand, says something totally different. That sicha b'shemen, that when you use shemen as an ointment on the human body, that is called a hana shelo kedarka. That shemen is not used as an oil. Now here the Mishnah Lamech claims that the reason why is not because, as I tried to argue before, because we used it only for tanning hides, but rather he says that shemen is royal amachal. That when you extract oil from the olives, it's designated and it's marketed for human consumption. Now, whether that means you drink oil straight, I don't think so, but you use oil in many different salads and so on for cooking. And therefore, what do you say?
But it was too early.
No, so the Rambam doesn't mention the fact that this was too early. So again, I'm just trying to show you that this sugya is sort of multifaceted. Number one, you know, I can give you three different explanations why Ravina did this thing. And he was nene from the oil of Arla. One is because it was bosar. And if it was bosar, Rashi says, lo nisbashel, it didn't ripen, and therefore it's not kederach. That's not when we extract the oil. The Rambam says that the only designation of oil when it's humanly edible is for achila, and if you use it for something other than achila, then that hana is considered shelo kedarka. And the first lishna of the Gemara says that her fever was so high that this comes under what we call pikuach nefesh. Now, there's a long note here. I'm going to try to give you the gist of it. He quotes a ritva, and he says the following. According to one school of thought in the Rishonim, shelo kedarka in the case of Hanah is only derabbanan. And therefore, our Gemara in the second Lishna is establishing a brand new principle. And what is that? That you're allowed to violate an isa derabbanan litzorech refuah even in the case of a chole she'ein bo sakana. So Rabbi Osai, this is going to have tremendous implications in halacha. The Ritva is deriving for Ask Sugya that Ravina did not mean to say that Shalom Kedarch is mutter. He understood that Shalom Kedarch Hana Osam is awesome, but it's only awesome in Rabbanon. And even if I grant you, as the second Lishna assumes, that there was no Sakana, and that was also the assumption of Marbar Ravashi in this question, nevertheless, I'm allowed to violate an Isid Rabbanon for the sake of a Chola. So take, for example, a person who never has a migraine headache, are they allowed to take medicine on Shabbos? Now, medicine on Shabbos is a whole to-do. You know, it's very complicated. But let's oversimplify it. And don't take anything that I say, you know, seriously. Aspirin, which can be purchased over the counter, is also on Shabbos. I mean, again, that's pretty heavy, what I'm just telling you. But they say that in the case, excuse me, of someone who's suffering to the extent that he has to get into bed, he's like basically non-functional. I've never had a migraine, but I was told that it's horrible. Such a person would be allowed, according to this Ritva, to take medicine on Shabbos, even though the medicine is over the counter, which is an Issur d'Rabbanan of refuah on Shabbos. Again, you could have a million applications of this rule, that whenever the Issur could be reduced from a Doraisa to the Rabbanan, then for the sake of a Chol Hashem Bo Sakana, the Ritva would say, we're allowed to override that Issur. Now, he quotes the Ran. The Ran says the following, that Af Bi Issurim D'Rabbanan, Lo Hi Tiru L'Tzorch Refuah, in a case where there's no life-threatening situation, Ela Dafka Imushalo Kederech Hanasa. So in other words, what the Ran is doing is he's taking the following, he's saying there's a universal category called Durabonon, Issur Durabonon, and then there's something that reduces the Issur to a lower level than a Durabonon. You know, he's creating a hierarchy that has A, B, and C, right? I don't know in which direction you want to go. Let's go Minachomur Elakal. So the most chomur, we'll call it A, on top of the totem pole, is going to be an Issur D'Oraisa. Number two, which is number B, going down one level, is an Issur D'Rabbanan. And then we have a third level, according to the Ran, which is Shalom Kedarka. If it's unusual, then it's not even a D'Rabbanan. It's like a quasi D'Rabbanan. It's one level below. And then Afkamina is going to be Litzorach Refuah. A classic violation of an Issur D'Rabbanan would be prohibited for the sake of a Chol Hashem Bo Sakana. But in a case of Shlok and Darka, says the Ran, because the Issur D'Rabbanan is reduced by a notch to the lowest level of an Issur D'Rabbanan, there we will override that Issur, violate that Issur for the sake of what? Of Refuah. And that's what the Ritva has in mind. Yeah,
here's. I once heard a story about Rav Soloveitchik. Someone asked him, why are you so makel when it comes to Shabbos? He says, I'm not makel Shabbos, I'm machmir with pikuach
nefesh. Right. Yeah, the Rav was quoting Rav Chaim, actually. Oh. The critiques of Rav Chaim, they never understood. Rav Chaim was a machmir. Now what kind of machmir was Rav Chaim? It's amazing, because Rav Chaim had such a creative mind. To him, everything was lumdus. You know, he didn't care much about halacha l'maaseh. He cared about lumdus. So whenever they would ask him a question, he would go through the various possibilities, and he would always end up with a chumrah. Why? Because he always had the possibility that would be awesome based on his lumdus analysis. So they asked him, why is it that when it comes to pikuach nefesh, he was such a maker, like we told the story before, you know, you're not ma'aretz because you didn't turn the light down. And in many other cases, Reb Chaim was tremendously makil. You know, there's a case where you're allowed violating Shabbos because there was a chashash that they might take someone, you know, conscript him into the army. Other cases where he was makil. So that's when the Reb Chaim gave the answer. It's not that I'm makil in the East of Shabbos, I'm being machmer in Pikuach Nefesh. But again, now our discussion for this moment, the title is Chol Sheein Bo Sakana. So we're not talking about Pikuach Nefesh. We're talking about misery and we're talking about suffering, but not Pikuach Nefesh. And the Ran is saying that there's a separate category called Shalom Kedarka. And if it's Shalom Kedarka, that's not even a full-fledged Issur D'Rabbanan. And finally, at the end of this paragraph, he quotes the Ra'ah, Rabbeinu Aaron HaLevi. He was a contemporary of the Rashba. And he writes that if you hold that Hanah Shalom Kedarka is muteris l'chadchila, then the heter is not because of choli. What Ravina was arguing was that since this is Shalom Kedarka, the way Rashi understood it, the way the Rambam understood it, therefore it's mutter. The Rabbanan never even prohibited something that's Shalom Kedarka. And therefore, b'chol inyan, muto limshok shemen shall zeisei bosar, because bosar is shalom kedarko, and has nothing to do with refuah. No, it's the second answer of Ravina, according to the Ravina's self-defense, had nothing to do with refuah. You know, that he dropped. In the first Lishna, it was all because of refuah. In the second Lishna, forget about refuah. It was muta because it was shalom kederach hano'oso. Yes, we're talking about Arlo, which is Doraisa, and yet we're saying Shalom Kederach. But the Chiddush Ra'oi is that once it's Shalom Kederach, it's Mutal Chatchil, it's not even also the Rabbanon. Most of the Shitas would say one of two things, that it's for Shalom Kederach, it's also in the Raisa without Malkus, or at least, I grant you, it's also in Rabbanon. The Ra'oi went to the other extreme, and he said if it's Shalom Kederach, like the case of Bosar and Zeisei Arlo, then it's Mutal Chatchil, and the Rabbanon didn't even prohibit it. What probably the Ra'o has in mind is that it is certain things are unusual because the object is dedicated or designed for, you know, singled out for a certain use, and you used it for a different use, and nobody would have anticipated that. But then you have something which is nobody would do it. I mean, it's counterintuitive. It's financially not viable to cut down the zesim at the state of Bosar and extract oil from Bosar. It's just not. It's unheard of. Why is it unheard of? Because basically, pardon the expression, it's a stupid thing to do. You don't wait. You don't cut down zesim at that stage in order to extract. Okay, Rabosai. Now, the next 10 minutes that we have, we're going to try to touch base on one of the most profound and relevant sugyas in all of Shas. And I may sound very dramatic, and that's what I want to be, is dramatic, but it's really true. This is an amazing, amazing sugya. Now, if Phil was here, but Phil can't be here, he would make me a little bit of a table. You know, you need a table. This table, by the way, is not a complicated table. It only has four boxes in it. Because there are only two variables. And the question is what's called Hana Habali Adam Bal Korcha. It means the following. I'm walking down the street, and there's an idolatry temple over here, temple for idolatry, and they're worshipping their idols with incense. They used to burn incense in front of their idols. So what happens inevitably is that if I'm walking down the street, and it reminds me, Lahavdil, you know, if you know where Angel's Bakery is, or Bourbon's, whatever your favorite bakery, I mean, sometimes within a radius of like a kilometer, you know, you're overwhelmed by the smell. So apparently the incense that they used in these temples was was an intense incense. And, you know, if you're walking down the street, you can even try to cross the street, but you're going to be overwhelmed by the smell of that incense, which is Hana from Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara calls this Bal Korcho. Why is this Bal Korcho? I didn't seek out to enjoy the smell of the odor of the pleasant fragrance of this incense. It happened. It sort of like was forced upon me. On the other hand, I could have gone down a different street, theoretically. It would have caused me to take a circuitous route, but nevertheless, I could have avoided any close proximity to the temple. So there are a number of elements here that go into the equation. The most critical elements are twofold. Number one, is it Efshar or EFshar? Maybe I should write this on the board if I find. Does anybody know if there's... I'm afraid to look. Yeah. I should have been afraid to look. Anyway, if we find this... So, Don, you'll have to take a dictation here. There's something called Efshar velo Efshar, which means... Given the circumstances, he had no choice but to pass by the monastery, the temple. Oh, thank you. Efshar v'lo efshar. That's your first element in the equation. Okay? Efshar, and the opposite is lo efshar. Then there's another element in the equation, and that's miskaven or lo miskaven, right? Mitkaven, miloshen kavon. In other words, even if I had no choice... Meaning, in order to get from point A to point B, I'd have to pass through, you know, the street of the monastery, because there's no other way of getting there. It's not like I could have taken a different route. But I didn't have to have kavanah. I didn't have to desire to smell the odor and enjoy the benefits of that odor. Now, the Gemara is going to say the following. We're going to have a machlokes shinabai v'rova, but the Gemara is first going to cut down this machlokes out of the four cases, the four possible scenarios, as we'll explain, to only one out of the four. There are going to be two extreme cases that are asur and one extreme case that's certainly mutter, and then there's going to be that vague, ambiguous case right in the middle, and that's going to be the subject of a gigantic controversy between Abaye and Rav. So the Gemara says like this: if it was lo efshar, the lo kamachamim, everybody agrees that's mutter. You're allowed to go down this street knowing full well that you'll smell the odor of the incense of Avodah Zarah, because two conditions were met. Check off the following two boxes. Number one, it was low efshar. There was no other way of getting to my destination. And number two, it was low kamachamim. I didn't, you know, like, that's a good smell. You know, I didn't have any intention. On the other extreme, there's a case of efshar vikamachavi. That for sure would be awesome. So whereas low efshar vikamachavi would certainly be mutter, there's no element of participation. On the other polar extreme, we have efshar vikamachavi. He could have easily gone down another path. And not only that, he had kavanah to enjoy the smell. So those two cases, polar extremes, are either mutter in the case of lo efshar v'lo kamachavin, or asur in the case of efshar v'kamachavin. Oh. Now the Gemara says the following. Fine. All right, so lo efshar, oh. The Gemara says the following. Oh, there's another case that's also clearly asur, and less mandapolik, nobody would debate it. And that's called lo efshar vikamachave. Even though he had no other way and route of getting to his destination, but nevertheless, he didn't have to have kavanah. So once he has kavanah, everybody agrees that that's going to be asur. Oh. So where is the machlokas? So the Gemara says that the machlokus is going to be in the case of efshar v'lo kamachave, which means that he didn't have kavanah. Kavanah would be an automatic oser. But even though he didn't have kavanah, he was in a state of efshar. He could have easily gone on another road. And that's going to be the machlokes between Abaye v'Rav. So if you just read this line, because we don't have time to go through the whole sugya today, we'll do it tomorrow, Sunday, Mr. Shem, it says the following. Itmar, hanah habolo li'odam al karcha. In other words, since we're talking about a case of eno miskavin, right, let's say, if he's eno miskavin, because again, that has to be the premise here, that he doesn't have kavanah, because kavanah is an automatic oser. But it's bal karcho. So what does that mean? That even though he didn't have kavanah, inevitably the smell came into his nose and he enjoyed the benefit of it. Abaye omer muteris, that's okay. Why? Because since he didn't have any kavanah, even though again he could have gone down another road, nevertheless, without kavanah he's not chayev. V'rava amar asura. Rav is going to say asura. Why? Because even though he had no choice in the sense that the odor was imposed upon him and he had to smell it, but nevertheless, Rav argues that since it was efshar, since he could have gone down a different path, then halacha requires him to do so. So Rav Osai, before I say goodbye to you for today, and maybe I'll wish you Shabbat Shalom, I just want to mention a tshuva Rav Moshe Feinstein, just that you should appreciate how relevant this sugya is. You won't believe it. This question was asked to Rav Moshe, and it's relevant, very relevant today, certainly in Israel, and I think maybe even in Chutz Laretz, you can find scenarios for those who like to travel. And Rav Moshe brilliantly quoted this sugya. He made that analogy. The question was, we don't go to mixed beaches. where the women are not dressed properly. I mean, that's an understatement, right? But what happens if he's at point X and he wants to bathe in point Z, and in order to do so he has to pass by point Y? So to get from X to Z he has to go through Y. Y is a mixed beach, Z is a separate beach for men. In order for him to get to his separate beach, he's got to pass by the mixed beach. So Moshe is going to say the following. Let's first ask question number one. Is there any other way that he can get to the separate beach? Maybe he could take a helicopter. Maybe he could go all the way around. The second question is going to be, what is his kavana when he passes through the mixed beach? Is he looking at the women and having hanah from what's called Gili Arayos from Erava? Or he's just passing by and he's making careful, you know, making sure of himself that he's not trying to, you know, do any action that would indicate that he's seeking out this pleasure. But the brilliance of Rav Moshe, I think, in that tshuva, maybe we'll get a chance to go through that tshuva, I don't know, is that he makes the equation to our sugya. That this is a case of Hanav Gili Arayos, and it's Bal Karcho, it means he's not seeking it out, but he may be able to claim that it was imposed upon him. And then we go through the various variables. Is it Efshar or low Efshar? Is it Miskavin or low Miskavin? All right, Rabosai, now, just two announcements. This coming Sunday, I have a lecture, if anybody wants to join me, at 8 p.m. right here in the ELC. That's a pre-Purim shir that'll be half halacha, half hashkafa. And number two, this coming Tuesday, we'll have Emir Tzashem at regular classes Tuesday night. But the following Tuesday, I'm going to have to cancel. Tuesday night, I give two classes every week. You're always invited to join me. One is at 7:30 and the other is at 8:30. One is called Peleoates, the other is called Parsha. And that's good for next Tuesday as well. But in case I forget to tell you, the following Tuesday, this is important for you to know, we're having a Masechtathon. This became a minhag here, in which every person, together with the Chavrusa, takes upon himself one daf, two sides of a page, in this case, Shas Bavli, Masechta Megillah, in honor of Purim. And we hope to make a siyum a week from this Tuesday night on the entire Masechta Megillah. Now, how can you participate in a siyum by showing up here for an hour and a half with your chavrusa? The answer is it's a communal siyum. It's a new concept. When I was a kid, we didn't know such a thing—a communal siyum. So that's Emirat Hashem, I believe, a week from Sunday. I don't know exactly the date. Levin Yono. And that's it. So I wish everyone a great Shabbos, and Mr. Shem, we'll see you all on Sunday. Great to have you back. Yeah. Okay.